each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon, and welcome to Winds of Change. This is Mary Hallin Fiorito. I am the Cardinal George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is a beautiful spring day outside, April 27th, 2020. Would like to begin by giving a big happy birthday shout out to my eldest daughter, Gemma, the young woman that made me a mother, who turns 19 today. And we just wish her all the best. Those of you who are listening, say a prayer for her, because she has a big chemistry final this morning. She is a pre-med student at the University of Portland in Portland, Oregon, and so is continuing her e-learning. And so be grateful for a prayer for success in her exams. We need good, solid Catholic pro-life doctors in the world, as we all know. So I hope you all had a good week. You are keeping safe and keeping well and sheltering in place and taking all the necessary precautions to keep your family safe. I am very happy to be joined by someone who is a friend and a neighbor and a fellow mom at my parish, St. Vincent Ferrer in River Forest, Illinois, Ariane Fisher. Ariane, thank you so much for joining us today. Ariane, are you
Hi.
Hi. Are you there? Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Great.
Yep.
This is
I can.
From your shelter in place studio there. Thanks so much for joining us, Ariane. It's a great pleasure. I've been wanting to actually have you on for some time because you, every Saturday, I think, no weather keeps you away, are a sidewalk counselor at one of the Chicago area's busiest abortion clinics. And, you know, I think that's, it's an incredibly beautiful thing that you do, a wonderful witness, a wonderful, peaceful, nonviolent witness to help bring hope and hopefully saving lives from time to time and trying to, you know, be among women really at the most desperate points in their life, to be that maybe that final lifeline, literally and figuratively, that they might need. But before we get into talking about how you came to do that, Ariane, I always like to start by sharing with our audiences a little bit about the personal background of my guests. And you're very interesting because, unlike most of my guests, you're a convert to Catholicism, correct?
Yes.
So can you tell our listeners how you came into the Catholic Church, if you had any religious practice prior to becoming Catholic? Tell us a little bit about that faith journey.
Sure. I was raised Jewish, nominally Jewish.
Okay.
Reformed Jewish. And we were only raised that much because my parents had been kind of completely non-religious Jews, like secular Jews.
Uh-huh.
And we went to a place called I think it was called, when I was real little, which was just where they taught Yiddish and Jewish culture.
And where was that, in the Chicago area?
No, I grew up in New York.
Oh, okay. Wow. So
Wow. Yeah. And I found out after we were there about a year that I was the only one who believed in God.
Hmm.
And my catechism consisted of things like the Walton family reruns Little House on the Prairie.
Okay.
But they all talked about God.
Right.
And
so you mean your introduction to like Christianity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or religion at all, or
right.
God. And I kind of knew on some basic level that I believed in God, so I didn't want to go someplace where they didn't. And so our family joined the Reform Synagogue. And there, people did believe in God. They didn't keep kosher for the most part. So they weren't like very observant Jews, but right. They did have formal prayers and things like that. And that's how I was raised. My parents, if they believed in God, it was more nominal.
Okay. And so how did, so at what age did you start exploring Christianity? And I know you mentioned Little House on the Prairie and some of the other more wholesome, mm-hmm. you know, things that we used to have on television in those days, family shows. But yeah, which I think are frankly pretty much non-existent in today's, you know, television yeah. mainstream. I don't think I'm just, you know, other than maybe Last Man Standing, I can't think of any, you know, regular television show I would let my kids watch unless I had seen the episode first.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's pretty much true.
Yeah. And now, unfortunately, now it's true not only for, you know, just family shows in primetime, but also on, you know, things like on PBS. There's all sorts of messages about marriage and the family in particular that are being, you know, imposed upon our children on PBS shows. So now, you know, you just feel like there's nowhere safe for people who are really believing Christians, you know, it seems in today's world of television. But I don't want to digress too much. But so tell us a little bit more then about that, about
sure.
how first of all, how you became, you know, how you became a Christian and then a Catholic.
Sure. My first exposure was actually, so my dad had been born Jewish. He was bar mitzvahed, and then his family converted to Catholicism when he was 19.
Okay.
So he converted too. And actually, a priest included them in an anthology of Jewish converts, an actual book.
Wow.
Because they were pretty well known in Kansas City.
Right.
So there's my little digression. But then when he married my mom, he became Jewish again.
Okay.
So when I would visit grandparents, or my cousins, I would go to Mass with them.
Okay.
So I was exposed to it, and they were all very observant Catholics.
Okay.
So I was exposed to it, and my feelings about it was that the liturgy was extremely similar to what I saw in synagogue.
Okay.
It didn't feel out of place.
Okay. Well, you can't just say something like that and then run past it. tell me a little bit more about, unpack that a little bit for us.
Sure. Because in synagogue, we had the tabernacle that held the word.
Right.
And in Judaism, that was the scrolls. We had the ever-burning lamp above the tabernacle that was in a red glass. We had the candle. That was always burning.
Right.
There were the readings. There were times when you would stand up, when you would sit down.
So different posture changes
there was a homily. I don't think it was called a homily, but
something like that.
Yeah. And most familiar to me was the prayer, the Holy, Holy, Holy.
Okay.
Because we had that exact prayer, but in Hebrew it was called Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh.
Ah.
It was the exact same prayer.
Wow.
So to me it was, you know, okay, this is like the Catholic version of Judaism. That's
right.
How I kind of looked at it.
Okay,
Because it was the same. And then, so that was my exposure. And I grew up on Long Island in New York, where pretty much everyone I knew was either Catholic or Jewish.
Okay.
I don't think I met anyone Protestant until I was like 12 or 13.
Right. You know,
I didn't.
That's funny because I had I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and there were, well, as you know, in River Forest and Oak Park, there's a number of different synagogues that are there. Though you don't really see people kind of coming and going from them, you
mm-hmm.
know, as you would. Yep. As you would in other neighborhoods in Chicago where there's a more Orthodox Jewish community. And, you know, I remember being sort of caught in a, not exactly a traffic jam, but it was a walking people jam when I was up in West Rogers Park one Friday night. And then I realized the Sabbath was starting, so no one was driving and everyone was walking. But at any rate, there were, of course, you know, so I knew there were Jewish people in our community, but, you know, we had quite a big, there were, you know, you were either Roman Catholic or you were Missouri Synod Lutheran. Sort of on Chicago's west side. And the Lutheran, this is sort of an interesting fun fact, the Lutherans, the Missouri Synod Lutherans, had their own school system, like the Catholic schools. There was Grace Lutheran. There were two Lutheran high schools, Luther North and Luther South, and they were good schools and not quite as big as the Catholic system, obviously, But they were probably about the size of what the Catholic system is today was the size of the Lutheran system when I was growing up. So we did know, we had a couple of neighbors who were Missouri Synod Lutherans. And when I, in fact, I think it was one of my first dates with my husband, we went to a Christmas concert at a Missouri Synod Lutheran church, and I picked up the missal. And I mean, there's a rite of reconciliation and confession. There's prayers to Our Lady. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable from a Catholic church, you know, other than there's no tabernacle and, you know, but they have, there's a devotion to Our Lady. So it's very interesting. So I've had that one experience, but not on a repeated basis, like it sounds like you did when you visited your Catholic relatives.
Yeah, I mean, because I was little, my parents would send me, it was just me that was getting sent to visit relatives, and so I would go to Mass with them. So okay. I was pretty familiar with Mass. And then when I was in college, I spent a year in Scotland.
Oh, did you? Where?
Yeah, in Dundee.
Oh, no kidding.
Not a nice area.
No.
But,
okay, you know, my parents were from Scotland. Both my mom and dad. Yeah. But from the west coast of Scotland, a town named Paisley, which tends to be pretty, I mean, in terms of condensation of Catholics, it would be about the closest you'd get to a kind of a Catholic community, because you had so many immigrants from Northern Ireland who tended to be Catholics. Uh-huh. So, yeah. And then there were actual Scottish Catholics, those who never left the faith after the Reformation, which was quite brutal in Scotland. But you have to tell me a little bit more about this. What brought you? Were you there to study in Dundee?
Yeah. Okay. I was an engineering student at a college in New Jersey, and we had an exchange program. And Dundee is not like, it's very industrial. It's
right.
Like, think of the industrial parts of Chicago.
Right.
Like, that's what it was like. It wasn't like,
it's like the south, like the southeast side, sort of in Chicago, would probably be a comparison.
Yes.
Okay.
So it wasn't like, you know, there was beauty miles away from it, but not in Dundee.
Okay.
But I became friends with people who were Protestant, and that was my first exposure to really God fearing, good people who were very religious.
Right.
And they were all Protestant. But they were just, you know, wonderful people. And
so Scottish Presbyterians, I take it. That would be my guess.
There was Baptists. There were a few different
okay.
ones. But the interesting thing to me was when I became friends with a girl who was from Northern Ireland, and she used a phrase I had never heard. Like, I had never seen anti-Catholicism. I had heard it existed in America.
And it exists in Scotland in a way that is virulent. But, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, and she said, so she grew up in Northern Ireland, and this was early 90s, and she said, well, I have Catholic friends, and it was the exact same way somebody here who's trying to say they're not racist would
right.
say, I have black friends.
Right.
The exact same thing.
Yeah, Scotland was one of the only countries in the Western world where Christmas was not a legal holiday. So Christmas was not a legal holiday in Scotland until 1957, I think. So my parents' memories of Christmas Day are her, you know, both, you know, that people going out to work. So you had to get up and go to Mass at like 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. on Christmas Day because everybody had to go to, all the men had to go to work and some of the women as well. Because the Protestants there, the Scottish Presbyterians in particular, said the holiday was too papist. Christmas, you know, because obviously the word means Christ's Mass. So Christmas was very much considered a Catholic holiday, a papist holiday, as they called it. And so that's why you may remember this from your time there. You know, New Year's Day is a huge, New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, huge
yeah.
celebrations, because essentially they took the place of Christmas.
Yeah. And there were, yeah, like parades and parties in the street. I mean, that part's kind of like here, but
right.
It was,
but
yeah,
we also have Christmas as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, and I had a friend who he had worked as a mechanic, and he was telling me how his boss, so the Catholics, so they had a very strong Catholic school system in Ireland, but it was more like segregation. I mean, in Scotland, but it was more like segregation.
Right. Right. Because Catholic schools are free, and you know why that is, because the Protestants didn't want the Catholic kids going
Catholic.
To, they didn't want the intermingling between the Catholics and the Protestants. And so, so they made the Catholic schools free so that Catholic kids wouldn't be around their children. So it wound up working out well. You have free Catholic education there, which is a marvelous thing. But that just shows you the depth of the prejudice against people who were Catholic.
Yeah. And it gets worse because, so as a mechanic, when you would apply for a job, you had given your resume, and it's not something for which you need a degree, so you would put your high school down.
Ah.
And so the boss would see that it was a Catholic high school.
Ah.
And they would throw out the resume.
Oh, interesting. So
yeah.
That would be the way that you could tell
if somebody was Catholic or
that's
not.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they were very, it was just pervasive anti-Catholicism. And so I was Jewish at the time, and he invited me to go to one of their Baptist services. And so I went, and it was nothing similar to Judaism at all. Like, not a thing about it was, except maybe that they had a sermon. They had these things, I think they called them testimonials, where people would get up and talk about how they came to Jesus.
Right, like that witness, that witness testimony is very important, I think, in a lot of those Protestant traditions.
Yeah, and I think I went twice, and both times the people who got up were talking about how they had been Catholic, and they were fearful for their families because they're all going to hell, and Catholicism, you know, whore Babylon and the whole thing. and I was just like, what are they talking about?
Yeah, right.
And so I kind of made up my mind that that was nothing I wanted any part of ever, because it was nothing like Judaism. So it didn't even make sense to me that if Jesus was going to found a church, he would want it to be so different than what he knew as the way to worship God.
Right, right.
So I literally came out of there and I was like, I do not understand why anyone would do this and think this is what God wants.
Right, right. Well, that's, you know, it's very jarring if you've, and again, kids that grow up in like what I like to call the Catholic bubble, you've likely never had that kind of challenge, you know, to your faith or something like that from someone else. And so it's very jarring when it first happens. And, you know, I wonder how many parents kind of think to equip their kids to be able to, like St. Peter says, right, give a testimony for a reason for our belief. And I think Catholics, we're just not used to being to having to take that step, you know, as defenders of the faith or as apologists for the faith. Whereas I think evangelicals are really taught from the time they're very young how to be an apologist, and particular how to be an apologist to Catholics. But Ariane, the time is flying by here. We're going into our first break, and so when we come back, we'll fast forward to your entrance into the church, and then we'll talk a little bit about the beautiful thing that you do every Saturday morning with your sidewalk counseling. So listeners, you don't want to miss the rest of this interview with Ariane Fisher. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day. During this COVID-19 virus pandemic, offering you prayer and inspiration through your faith.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Because of the unprecedented COVID-19 virus pandemic, the Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's needs your immediate help. The Soup Kitchen is asking for your donations of water, juice boxes, individual food servings, hand sanitizers, and Lysol. The Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's is operating regular hours during this pandemic. The Soup Kitchen is operated by the Daughters of St. Mary Providence from the basement of St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, which serves over 21,000 meals per year. To offer your help, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That number again is 773-870-2435. 2435. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I am joined today by my neighbor and my friend and my fellow parishioner, Ariane Fisher, who is the mother of six children?
Seven.
Seven. Oh, who did I forget? I forgot Joan. Yeah. Is that whoever? Poor Joan. I'm sorry, Joan. It's like the scene from The Sound of Music where she can never remember Kurt's name. So, Ariane, we were talking a little bit about your conversion. You're in Scotland for your year abroad studying, and you meet a Protestant and go to Protestant services with this friend. And then let's fast forward a little bit, because I do want to get to talk to you about the sidewalk counseling that you do, which I imagine when you were Jewish, you probably could never have imagined doing something like that.
No, I was pro-choice.
Oh, were you really? Oh, so you've had like a double conversion. Okay.
Yeah.
What age did you come into the church?
I was 23.
Okay.
And I decided if I was going to look around at different religions, you know, I was going through that curious phase that most people do.
Right.
I should explore Judaism first.
Okay.
Because I felt like growing up Reform Judaism wasn't what God intended either.
Right.
So I explored Orthodoxy, and I got hung up on the kosher thing because there were different definitions of kashrut, it's called,
okay,
depending on which rabbi you followed. And I thought, well, that's not what God wanted either.
Right.
So then I called my uncle, who was the organist at his church, and I started talking to him a little bit, and I went to actually talk to a priest, and he gave me two of the worst books you could give somebody who's considering Catholicism. He gave me Augustine's Endocrydion, which is super hard to read.
Right.
And full of things that the church doesn't actually agree with.
Okay.
And he also gave me the book Catholicism by, I forget which heterodox priest it was, but it was a heterodox priest from Notre Dame.
Okay.
But it was kind of like, he gave me Catholic Light, which was an easy read,
okay,
and it wasn't too heterodox, and okay, he gave me like PhD level Catholic stuff.
Right. So, oh, good heavens. Okay.
And I started going once a week to just talk to him and discuss the books, and I explored, and that's how I wound up eventually coming into the faith.
And okay, and then had you met your husband at this point?
It was right around that time.
Okay. Okay.
So I was already kind of starting to explore a little bit the faith. I was kind of curious. I think when we had started dating, we were just like casually dating and no thoughts of anything for the future.
And is Mike a born Catholic?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he is. In fact, I think he might have been the one that loaned me the Endocrydion.
Okay.
But now that I think about it. But so we had gone on a camping trip with a bunch of friends, and we had only been dating a few weeks. And, you know, it was a Sunday morning, and he said he was going to Mass. And I was like, why would you go to Mass?
Uh-huh.
And he invited me to go along with him.
Oh.
And he's like, you don't have to go. I'm going to Mass. And none of his friends, who they all went to Catholic school, none of them went to Mass, but he did. And he invited me to go. And it was so beautiful. I started crying, and just like I do at Hallmark movies and everything else, I'm a crier. And I haven't missed a Mass since then.
No kidding. Wow. And so how long did you date before you and Mike were married?
I'm sorry, say that again?
I said, how long did you and Mike date then before you were married?
About 2.5 years.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, so wow. So that's a long time. Wow.
Yeah. And he did not want me to convert for him.
Okay.
So I was kind of exploring all around the same time, but he kind of thought we should see each other less while I was converting, because he didn't, you know, if our relationship didn't work out, he didn't want me to not be Catholic.
Right,
all of a sudden.
Right.
So... yeah, so that was part of it. But he's my godfather.
Oh, is he? Oh, that's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. And you have 7 children. Now, I know that your eldest is 19, yes?
Yep.
And Joan, poor Joan, who I forgot, is 2? About 2?
4.
Oh, Joan is 4. Gosh,
4.
See, I tell you, this is how... Well, see, we don't go to the night. Ariane and I met because at one point when my children were smaller and we still all made it to the 9 o'clock Mass... the Fishers, of course, were always a regular family there as well. And now that I've got a college age and a teenager, they tend to sleep in. So we go to the later Mass. So that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. But so Ariane, so you said you were pro-choice. Is that something that was difficult? Was that the most difficult hurdle coming into the Catholic Church? The Church's stand on abortion?
No, Jesus as God was the most difficult hurdle for me.
Interesting. And that not Mary, not foreign. The Pope, not...
No.
Okay.
No, I liked the idea that there was a Pope, because the reason I left Judaism was that there wasn't a catechism, there wasn't a definitive answer on things.
Right, there wasn't a central authority. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just ignored Mary.
Okay, I see. All right.
But yeah, so in our RCIA class, they did have one handout on abortion, and I was like, well, I can still convert. I just don't agree with this part. And Mike's like, no, you can't.
Yeah.
So I started looking into it, and Mike kind of challenged me because I was very pro-choice.
Oh, wow.
Very,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Were you active in any groups, any abortion advocacy groups?
No, but I would have argued with anybody, you know, I was very offended, you know, just like pro-choice, a lot of pro-choice people are now. I was very offended by the whole pro-life movement. I thought it was none of their business. And I always used to say I would, you know, if I got into that situation, I would definitely keep it, but it's everybody else's choice what they would want to do.
Right.
But I would never do that.
Right.
And then Mike challenged me and he said, well, why wouldn't you get one? And no one had ever asked me that. And it was such a simple question.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, because it would be my child. And he's like, yeah.
Right.
And he just made me think about it, you know, his classic Socratic method.
Right.
And I had a lot of friends that had abortions when I was in college who didn't tell me till afterwards.
Yeah.
I think I figured out I had 10 friends that had abortions who told me after. So people knew, you know, I had said, well, yeah, it's definitely a woman's right. I wouldn't get one.
Right.
And I wound up asking one of those friends, why didn't you tell me before?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, obviously you would have tried to talk me out of it.
Oh, interesting. Even though you were pro-choice at the time.
I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, you might have said you were pro-choice. You weren't really.
Wow.
And
interesting.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, well, and perhaps because I saw that you were exploring different faiths and that you were.
No, this was before that.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I was not exploring faith, nothing like that. She recognized something in me that I didn't recognize in me.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I grew up in a pro-life household, of course. It was simply, you know, abortion was something that was never spoken of in positive light. But I knew two women, who would be women now, but girls when we were in high school, but they didn't go to my high school, but they were from my neighborhood who both had abortions. And one of them, you know, she had aborted a pair of twins, actually, and attempted to commit suicide. And then another friend, you know, just who the boyfriend had just kind of said, you know, you're on your own, you make your own decision, you're on your own. And of course, this would have been, you know, in the 80s when the abortion rate in the United States had just skyrocketed. And we didn't know a lot about post-abortion aftermath and, you know, those sort of things. And so, so just seeing the impact that particularly on my friend who had the twins, and she would write these poems about her babies that she had, you know, it just was awful. And seeing its impact on women is what have sort of propelled me then to get more involved when I got to college and then definitely when I was in law school. Because I saw how much it hurt women. And I think sometimes, you know, so it was interesting that this friend, this is kind of maybe a parallel story to yours, sought me out to tell me about the abortion and asked me if I, you know, I could help her to talk to a priest because she wanted to go to confession. So thankfully, you know, I was in the parish youth group. No, it was great. I mean, that my parish youth group, and this was before there was a Project Rachel, where you have now, of course, priests who are specially trained to hear the confessions of women who've had abortions and men who are the fathers of aborted children. But we didn't have that then. But, you know, this was the young adult kind of youth group pastor at my parish, and he heard her confession. So that was it. But it was interesting. Like, again, there must be something that people can see in pro-life women that leads them to believe that we would not, abortion is not something we would think would be a good thing.
Right.
Yeah. And so,
right.
Okay. So, so you come into the church and you and Mike get married, and did you have a difficulty with the church's teaching on contraception?
No,
not at all.
No,
yeah.
Actually, no. The way I always wanted a big family from when I was little.
Yeah.
Even though I only had one sibling, but my uncle in Joliet had 10 kids, and I thought that was the best thing
wow.
ever.
Yeah.
So I always wanted tons of kids. In fact, I didn't go back for my master's degree because I thought, well, I want to have a lot of kids someday, and who would raise them?
Right.
So,
right.
That was why I didn't do it. So we went through, as part of our marriage prep, we went through a class through our church. And this, I think, was really powerful. And I've checked into it in our diocese, and they don't really offer, as far as I could tell, a specific class on this.
By natural family planning, do you mean?
Yeah. And it was a class that was given by a couple in our parish who hadn't been following natural family planning. They had been using artificial contraception and mm-hmm. then started using natural family planning. And they talked about the change in their marriage.
Yeah.
And,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
It just, I was like, well, yeah, that totally makes sense. And, for Mike, it was eye-opening because nobody had ever talked to him about that before.
Right.
I will say, are failures at natural family planning completely. I would not recommend us as people to talk to for advice on it because I think we did it wrong. But that's okay. We have seven blessings.
You have seven beautiful children. And, you know, I always like the sort of thought of, you know, leaving God room to work in your marriage, right? And and sometimes, you know, for obvious, you know, for reasons of, you know, medical issues or financial issues, I mean, prudent couples can prudently decide to postpone, you know, if they're doing, if they're using natural family planning, which I, you know, we took classes at actually St. Francis Hospital in Evanston at the time we were going through pre-Cana offered classes. So so we actually got to go to a hospital, and I think there were maybe six other couples in the class with us. But I do remember from our pre-Cana weekend, which was separate from the NFP class, that I think there was maybe, and this was a large group because we went on a large weekend, there was a large group of couples there. And it wasn't only clear that most of them either were contracepting already or were planning to contracept, but I would say a good 50% of them were already cohabiting. And and I felt bad because, you know, we know now, I mean, what the statistics for couples who cohabit, their divorce statistics are alarmingly higher than those who don't cohabit before marriage. But also, if you cohabit and you use contraception, artificial contraception, that's two strikes against permanency in your marriage. And couples who use NFP, I think, have less than a 5% divorce rate. So it not only has benefits for the environment and for women's health, because, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize the birth control pill is a first-class carcinogen. It's considered the World Health Organization has characterized it as a level one carcinogen, and it's in our water supply, and it's affecting our fish populations. And, you know, hormonal contraception has not on balance been good for women or helpful for women. And there are ways to control your fertility that are much healthier, much more natural. You know, it's interesting. I have a friend who at the time, she was a non-Catholic, she was Episcopalian, but she taught NFP classes in Hyde Park, which is a little more gentrified now than it was where she lived there. I mean, you were really, it was kind of the intellectual beatnik crowd when she lived there. But she, most of her clients in her NFP classes were non-Catholics, but they were very much like environmentalists and people who were already doing farm-to-table living, you know, and growing most of their own food, that sort of stuff. And they simply couldn't imagine using artificial methods to space their children. But the thing is, I think why you see some couples going to it is that the men object, and which always makes me very sad. You know, I had my youngest daughter when I was 43, and I remember, you know, moms coming up to me on the playground saying, I always wanted one more, but my husband said no. And, you know, and then I remember one man, like, joking, saying to his wife, you know, when I was holding my daughter, and saying, oh, don't get too close, you're going to want another one. You know, and that just, you know, there's, to me, was like nothing more heartbreaking than hearing something like that.
Yeah, it's, well, and actually, now that you say that, there was a couple I counseled, well, more so I counseled the husband on Saturday morning, who they had five kids already, and their youngest was 10. So my rule of thumb is usually if a woman is laughing on her way into the clinic, she's obviously not going for an abortion. That's usually what I feel like,
okay.
You know, and it's usually proven out to be true. Like, she's going in for some other reason, because they do offer other services.
Okay.
That was not the case this time, so I stand corrected. She was laughing with him. They were kissing. She got out. They were laughing some more. She went in. And so I talked to him, and I said, your girlfriend, your wife is going in. And he said, yeah, that's my wife. We have five kids together. Our youngest is 10. She just didn't want it anymore.
Hmm.
And he's like, I wanted the baby, but you know, it's not my body, so I have no say.
Oh,
and
wow.
he said, well, you do. It's your child.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was just ambivalent at best. He wanted the baby, but he didn't really care.
Yeah.
And felt like he couldn't tell her what to do. Wasn't interested in information. So I gave him some information on counseling for afterwards.
Yeah.
I said, she's probably going to need help.
Right.
But so he did want the child. And she was fine with getting an abortion. She was happy about it,
yeah.
Which is not something I usually see.
Right. That's interesting. Well, you know, Ariane, I think we're going to go to our next break now. And
okay.
So when we get back, I really want to just dive into this. I want you to quickly tell us why you started to do this ministry. And
mm-hmm.
then... you know, let's just have a really frank talk about what you see and what it's like to be a sidewalk counselor. So listeners, please don't go
sure.
away. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Winds of Change holds in our hearts and prayers those who gave their full measure in defense of our nation. Remember their sacrifice on this day of remembrance, Memorial Day.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy with us at 3 p.m. Central Time. Streamed live from St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Go to the St. Stanislaus Kostka Church Facebook page and pray with us daily at 3 p.m.
Have mercy on us and on the whole world.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change, and I'm joined by Ariane Fisher, who is the mother of seven beautiful children. I have seen this, so I'm not just saying that. And also is a sidewalk counselor at an abortion clinic in Chicago that's been there for a very long time. Ariane, when I first started, being more active in the pro-life movement, I used to pray in front of that clinic as well. It's a clinic right off of the Kennedy Expressway on Washington. And this clinic is particularly, you know, heinous. They all are. But this is one that does abortions right up to 24 weeks. So elective abortions,
they
right?
They might do it later now.
Well, yeah, their website says 23 weeks, 6 days. But the doctor is the one who gets to certify the gestational age. So they could very well be doing them later, but they just certify them as being 23 weeks, 6 days, or 5 days. So, yeah, so it's the abortion provider who makes that call. And you know, you'll have women who, you know, they don't chart, so they don't know when their last period started. So they very well may not know, gosh, you know, how far along you are. And generally, you know, you can do a ultrasound to get a, you know, neck-to-rump measurement to kind of guess. But the doctor can always fudge those numbers. But tell me why you think that they're doing it even later.
Well, it's more, I'm supposing that, and I'm not exactly sure, but because when they used to say it was 23 weeks, 6 days was when it was only legal to that point.
Right.
And now it's legal for all 9 months.
Well, yeah, it always, it actually always has been, because the health exception overrides. The health exception in Roe versus Wade's companion case says that, A, the doctor gets to decide what health means, And health means things like the woman's age, emotional factors, how many children she has. So he, what technically the law said was elective abortions are legal up until 24 weeks. You can't have an abortion after 24 weeks unless you have a health reason. But then the health reasons include things like the woman's age, whether or not she might be depressed, all sorts of reasons that people don't normally associate with health. But interestingly, what happens then when you're doing, as you know, the later you do the abortions, the longer they take. They can take up 2 to 3 days because you have to, you know, manually open the cervix enough. There's greater risks that come with that. So some abortion providers simply just don't want to do them that late. And you will find them, however, being done in hospitals. You know, when I worked for the Archdiocese and I worked in the pro-life office, we did get a call one time on our Project Rachel line, oddly enough, from a chaplain at Northwestern, at Prentice, because they were doing an abortion on a baby with Down syndrome who was 7 months, the wife was 7 months along when they decided to terminate, and they wanted a priest to come and baptize the baby. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure. Well, you know, you see how easily people confuse Project Rachel with healing after abortion with somehow some kind of justifying abortion, which is not what the program's about at all. And I remember, of course, you know, you can't baptize somebody who's dead. So I said to the chaplain, listen, you can't baptize a person who's dead already. Would they let the baby be delivered? And then we could have the priest come in. And she could see what I was trying to do. I mean, I was trying to plead for this child's life. And I said, you know, we actually did at the time have a waiting list of families who would not just willing, but wanted to take children with Down syndrome. Sometimes they already had a Down syndrome child in the family and they, you know, were aware of the both the challenges, but also the blessings of having a child with Down syndrome. And there are blessings. But she just kind of quickly got me off the phone and it was very, very sad. It was the week before Christmas. And I just, but you know, you can for cases, what they would call fetal anomaly or depression in the woman, those kind of things, you know, can do them later. And remember at Christ Hospital, this is how the whole Born Alive Infant Protection Act came about. What they were essentially doing was inducing labor among babies that were pre-viable and just letting them die in the linen closet. Mm-hmm. They would and they would die. Sometimes they would die quickly. Sometimes it would take a couple of hours. But they were just and they were calling it, you know, an early miscarriage or a stillborn birth when essentially it was just a live birth abortion. So it's are you seeing when you go in? So you go every let's back up and just kind of talk to our listeners a little bit about what sidewalk counseling is, because I think, you know, abortion advocates try to make anyone who's standing outside of a clinic, you know, they compare us to people who are violent or who, you know, want to do things to, you know, who yell at women and demean them. And quite it's quite the opposite is true. So can you tell us a little bit about what sidewalk counselors do and then how you got involved?
Sure. Well, sidewalk counseling until about 5 years ago actually entailed counseling women. Outside. And then about 5 years ago, actually it was probably more, they passed the bubble zone law.
Right.
So, which said that within a 50-foot radius of the clinic's door, you could not be, if you were within 8 feet of the woman, you could not extend your arm and offer any literature. You could not try to educate her, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously around that time, there started to appear escorts outside the clinic.
Yes.
And those are the women, usually women, who wear neon vests,
right,
who claim to be volunteers. I don't know if they're volunteers or paid, but claim to be volunteers. And yet at the same time, when the police arrive, claim to speak on behalf of the clinic, which they could not do
because they're not employees.
If they were volunteers.
Right. They're not employees,
right.
Correct.
So they can't have it both ways.
Right.
If they're employees, then they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it because they're getting paid.
Right.
But anyway, so they started appearing to, quote, you know, enforce the bubble zone and, quote, you know, protect the women going in from the big bad counselors.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what wound up happening, though, is instead of being able to be compassionate and have a compassionate, quiet conversation with the woman, all of a sudden, you're having to raise your voice over the sound of the escorts, and I'm not kidding here, making fart noises, coughing, yelling. When we would say there's free ultrasounds, they would start yelling free sex, or free puppies. So it's no longer the compassionate conversation.
Right. And that's what you're there for, to offer, to be sort of that last moment lifeline to a woman, to say, there are a multitude of options available for you. And so talk about some of the things that, you know, that you're able to do now that the bubble zone ordinance is being enforced. And, you know, do the escorts for the abortion clinic call the police on you? Kind of what's a typical Saturday like for you?
Yeah. So, well, right now it's amazing. We can actually counsel. Since the shutdown, we can actually counsel.
And tell me why that is.
Because, well, A, it's busier, and B, there's fewer representatives of the clinics out there.
Okay.
So we've actually been able to talk to women, and it's a beautiful thing. Even if they've already had the abortion, we're actually able to get literature in their hands to get counseling that they need.
Okay.
Because if the clinics were to offer counseling, it would be like saying, there's something wrong with what you did.
Right, right.
But they don't offer counseling.
Right.
So on a typical Saturday, though, they used to call the cops on us quite a bit. They slowed that down because they found business didn't do as well if there were police cars in front.
Interesting.
They tend to not call the police. But typically, they would bring a, one of those USB speakers and play. So like I said, one escort had on loop, fart noises and things like that at top volume right next to me as I'm praying the rosary.
Right.
Or they would, you know, just start yelling over us, things like this. They claim that they are representing the woman, so they're allowed to be within the bubble zone.
Okay.
So that they're allowed to be within 8 feet. This is what they claim, but the actual law was, it wouldn't have been legal for them to write a law that only applied to one person. It has to apply to all citizens. Right,
right. Right. Oh, so, of course, right.
Right. So the 8 feet radius is for anyone. You cannot go within 8 feet unless invited by the woman. That's what the law says, for anyone. The escorts routinely break this, and they say they were invited by the woman.
Right.
They couldn't have been. They just got out of their car.
Exactly.
So the only way they could be invited is if they were employees of the clinic and lined this up ahead of time, rather than volunteers, as they claim, or they're not equally enforcing it.
Okay.
So there's actually a case before the Supreme Court right now that's waiting. It's advanced to that point because the police would come when they called and they would say, okay, you pro-lifers, you cannot be within 8 feet, but you escorts can. And a federal judge said, no, Chicago Police Department.
Okay.
Nobody can be within 8 feet, or everyone can be within 8 feet, but you cannot do it this way.
Yeah.
So they were supposed to set up a hotline for the police to call, so they could tell the difference. But they cannot say that the escorts can be within 8 feet and we can't. That's not legal. And that's where it stands right now.
Okay.
And we are allowed to be within 50 feet. We just cannot be within 8 feet of a woman without her inviting us.
So how long have you been doing the sidewalk counseling? And what was it that motivated you to start doing it?
It's about 2 years. When we first moved to Chicago, I did go to the Albany Clinic up on Milwaukee several times.
Yes, which is now closed.
And then I suffered a miscarriage.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I could not bear to see women going in and doing that to their children. And so I didn't go back for many years. Probably like 15 years or more, 17 years.
Okay.
So I did go to a couple of rallies downtown, and I did go to a few different events for 40 Days for Life. I would take my kids. I had somebody spit on me in front of the kids outside Ogilvie Station.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it was just unreal and all kinds of things, you know, cursed at us and everything else. And then, and I saw the uneven news coverage. You know, there might be a, you know, several hundred people.
Uneven is generous. That's a very generous way to describe it.
You know, like several thousand people. I think this year there were 2,000, but like, let's say one time I went and maybe there were 1,000 pro-life people and there were, you know, 10 pro-choice people. The news would say, make it appear like there were an even number of groups there.
Right, exactly.
Even number of people.
Right.
And
that consistently happens with the Chicago March for Life, where, you know, you might get 30 counter-protesters, and there's somewhere in the area of 3,000 Chicagoans, you know, at the march. And then they make it look as if the two sides are equal and, you know, equal and opposite parts of the story, when in fact the story is the march. And you have 30, you know, oh, God, I mean, I'm trying to be charitable, but, you know, half of them look like they're from the, you know, rejects from the Island of Misfit Toys. And they're all there screaming at people. I mean, the rage that comes from them is, I've experienced it myself. It's really remarkable. And I don't just mean anger. I mean rage. And I find that just a very fascinating part of the whole sort of abortion dynamic is the anger with which some of their activists project onto other people. Have you found that when you've been at the clinic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had people, well, because I do Facebook Live videos from the clinic.
And that's how I came to know. Yeah, that's how I came to know that you were doing it. I mean, you and I had never really even talked about this. And then I started watching your, I'm a regular fan of your Facebook feed on Saturday mornings. Well, you know, it's important because, and here's like, I was trying to explain this to actually a reporter who was interviewing me for another story on Friday. And I said, you know, the pro-life movement, because she wanted it, she said, you know, she wanted a quote from someone in pro-life leadership about someone who would, whose organization would not, you know, be my cup of tea in pro-life. I said, but you know, pro-life is a very big, diverse organization, right? I mean, you have everybody from Rehumanize International, whose spokesperson, you know, is a bisexual atheist. And then you have, you know, the Knights of Columbus and the Sisters of Life. I mean, I think people think of, you know, the pro-life movement as just being this big monolithic, you know, Catholics with their rosaries and everybody with 10 children, when in fact, it's an incredibly diverse social justice movement.
Yeah, it is. There's definitely atheists, and it's not. I would say like it's more like a group of people who individually show up on Saturday mornings. At least where I go, it's not like one person's in charge or anything like that.
Right. And do you? Are there others who are regulars there with you, or do you?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so how many of sidewalk counselors would you have?
So at the time, I usually go from around 9 to 11 on Saturday mornings. There's others. There's some who come from St. John Cantius a little bit earlier. There's some who come a little bit later. But at the times I go, there's about 4 or 5 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be lovely if we could line the streets with people.
Right.
And it would also be amazing if we could have priests there. And unfortunately right now, due to policy, priests are not allowed to be there, but, it would be amazing to have a monstrance there.
Yeah.
And there is a difference. Like when there are Baptist preachers who come sometimes.
Oh, okay.
And they try to counsel women and it's amazing. Now that's separate than sometimes we have people from the Moody Church, not the Bible Institute. And I don't even know if they're actual like approved representatives of the Moody Church.
The people who attend Moody. Yeah, I know a number of my Protestant friends in the pro-life movement who go to Moody, who worship there. And,
And so sometimes there's people who come who are nasty to women.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not what the pro-life movement is all about. It's not about yelling to women, you know, that they're sinners. You know, that's not, to me, that's not the time to evangelize.
Right.
And especially, you know,
telling anybody, yelling at anybody and telling them they're a sinner is never a way to evangelize, no matter what the issue is, in my opinion. You'll catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, but it's, tell me about like what would, I'd like to hear. I know that in your Facebook, your live videos, I've seen, I remember I was just so heartbroken one Saturday when you talked about seeing a woman go in who was visibly pregnant. I mean, who was at least 24 weeks, if not more.
Yeah.
And I just remember you had such an anguished look on your face and how horrible it was, you know, to watch her go in. And again, I just want to emphasize, this is a freestanding clinic that does elective abortions. This is not a hospital. This is not a situation, you know, where women, their lives, if women's lives were in danger and they needed an abortion, they'd be in a hospital. They wouldn't be going to a freestanding clinic that may or may not have a doctor who even has admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. And there have been a number of lawsuits against the particular clinic that you pray at.
Yeah, and actually, I do have a question for you about that.
Yes.
Because some of these women are, in fact, lied to by their doctors and told that they have a life-threatening illness and they have to go to a clinic to get an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
In the case where a woman gets one of those awful diagnoses, you know, that where the doctor follows up the diagnosis with, by the way, you're a better mother if you abort your child.
Right.
Why would they be going to a freestanding clinic rather than getting it in the hospital?
Right, exactly. Because, well, a couple of reasons. First of all, it might not be a hospital, you know, that her OBGYN might not do late-term abortions. And so therefore they send them to clinic because it's not an emergency. It's not emergency medicine. And sometimes there are particular, like Catholic hospitals obviously are not doing these kind of scheduled late-term abortions on disabled children. So sometimes it's a hospital policy. For example, I know of a hospital that actually does late-term abortions, post-viability abortions, but they have to be approved. They have an ethics panel, and the abortion has to be approved by an ethics panel of three different, I think there's an ethicist and two doctors on it, something like that. So, So it could be that the woman's doctor has, you know, her OBGYN has his only privileges are at a hospital that has one of these ethic boards, and he knows this abortion is not going to get past the ethics board. Because, for example, it could be just a child with Down syndrome, but with no other, you know, congenital abnormalities whatsoever. So, you know, again, there's a lot of confusion about why people have these post-viability abortions. Planned Parenthood, their own research on it. Planned Parenthood has a former affiliate. They're not formally affiliated anymore, but they were for many years, but they still work in conjunction with each other. The Guttmacher Institute, and Guttmacher did a study on women who had abortions after viability. And they found that the vast majority of the women who had abortions after viability were doing so for pretty much the same reasons that women were having abortions before viability. Women cited things like, I've been using illegal drugs and I'm afraid that they've harmed the baby. They don't know that for sure. They're just afraid of that. Or I've had an argument with my partner. He no longer wants to have this child. Or it took me a long time to get the money together for my abortion. And now it's past 20 weeks and I have to have it. But it took me, you know, I'm a waitress and it took me 4 months of saving to save up for my abortion. And my boyfriend wouldn't give me the money. So it's not for reasons that we're so often told, right? So, but Ariane Fisher, thank you so much for everything you do, for the witness that you are. I hope you'll come back on the show again and at other times so we can really get into this issue even more in depth. I hope you come back again.
Definitely.
Thank you. Well, God bless you. God bless your family. Listeners, it's been a joy to be with you. Stay safe. Stay inside. Save lives.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. Thank you.
that you say when right from wrong has become so obscure, it does not take that long. Can you see?